make him an offer again with you.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is Front Row Classics with NPR Illinois Community Voices. I'm your host, Brandon Davis. And joining me for this episode, of course, is my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going really well, Brandon. And how are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. And then also joining us is our friend Allison Means. How's it going, Allison?
Well, it's going well.
We could tell by the look on your face that it was going great.
Fabulous, yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we are here together because it is Oscar month. It feels like Oscar season's just dragging out because it is. But a couple months ago, we did a poll on our Facebook group of four different best picture winners, one from the 30s, one from the 40s, one from the 50s, and one from the 60s, and just left it up to our listeners as to which movie they wanted us to talk about for Oscar season. And they voted for the one from the 50s, the best picture winner of 1958, Gigi, which we will be talking about today. And we haven't talked about it. Well, we did talk about Sound of Music in January, but it'll be but, you know, we haven't talked about a lot of musicals together. So this will be this will be an interesting conversation. But Eric, before we get into the full discussion, do you want to give a plot summary?
Sure. Yeah, I'll briefly go over the plot of this one. So even though the film is called Gigi, in my mind, it sort of centers on a character named Gaston, who is a member of the Parisian elite in the early 1900s, which is sort of important to the plot of this film is the setting, too, because Gaston, like many of the other gentlemen of the time, is a member of the Paris social scene, which means that he takes women out on dates and makes financial arrangements with them and sort of has these group. There's a whole group of women who are sort of kept, and they're not married to these gentlemen. They're just, you know, I guess you'd almost say that they are mistresses or courtesans would be even a fancier word for it. So Gaston has done this several times in the past. However, he's just bored with the entire scene. So one of the only things that he finds joy in is calling on Madame Alvarez, who we later find out is the old mistress, or a former mistress of his uncle, who sort of has been playing the scene, the Paris social scene for years and years and years, who's, you know, probably retirement age and is a character in this as well that is sort of a parallel to Gaston. Gaston also, when he calls on Madame Alvarez, has a very fun relationship with her granddaughter, Gigi. So Gigi and Gaston sort of have this brother and sister relationship, and we learn that Gigi's sort of being trained to be one of these kept women by her great aunt Alicia, and that Gigi's mother, who we never see, has sort of taken the role as earning a living by being a singer, and is sort of looked down upon by these other women. After Gaston has a failed affair with a mistress falls for her skating instructor, and Gaston and his uncle publicly humiliate her. He calls on Madame Alvarez again, and while he's playing cards with Gigi, he promises to take her to his next excursion to the coast. So he does that, and when he returns, he realizes that Gigi is getting older, and so do her grandmother and her great aunt. And so they present Gigi sort of to Gaston in a new, very formal white dress as sort of a coming out for Gigi. And then Gaston, realizing that she's coming of age, proposes sort of a typical financial arrangement with Gigi's grandmother. But as soon as he takes her out and realizes that she's been trained to be sort of this mistress type person, he gets very upset. And he finally realizes that not only is she losing her innocence, but that he's also falling in love with her. And so in the end, he proposes that they have a different arrangement, an arrangement of marriage, and they get married and presumably live happily ever after.
Yeah, but before we get into first impressions, the one thing I always say when we talk about classics is the majority of movies made, I would say, before 1990 need context when you watch them. And this is a movie that Absolutely. Requires a lot of context. This was based off of, first it was a short novel written by a very famous French author named Colette. And she wrote it during World War II. Her husband was Jewish. He was in hiding. It was really dark days for her. And she decided to write a novel that sort of looked back to the times when she was growing up in Paris during sort of what many people consider the golden age of Paris in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And apparently while she was doing her research for this story, she was vacationing on the French Riviera, and she went to a hotel that was owned and operated by two aging courtesans. And they told her the story about them raising their niece to become a courtesan and to trap a millionaire, but their niece decided to break the family tradition and marry somebody for love instead. And thus began the novel, which became a French movie in 1948. And then Arthur Freed, who was a legendary producer of MGM musicals, and Vincent Minnelli saw the French movie, decided that they wanted to make it into a musical. And so that was sort of the impetus of that. But this movie is also very important in the world of the songwriters Lerner and Lowe, because this comes out 2 years after My Fair Lady opens on Broadway, and every studio is tripping over themselves to get the film rights to My Fair Lady. But it's so popular, it's the Wicked or Hamilton of its time, and it's touring all over the world, selling out all over the world. And Lerner and Lowe say the rights to My Fair Lady aren't going to be available for years. Mm-hmm. So everyone's tripping over themselves to make sort of a My Fair Lady. And MGM hires Lerner and Lowe to write and create an original musical just for the screen based on the story of Gigi. And so because 70% of the script is based off of the short story by Colette, this movie is very French. And you have to, and it really gives us a glimpse into a certain era of French culture. And so if you don't know that going into this movie, you're going to be surprised. So let's get started though, Allison. What are your, first of all, had you seen Gigi before?
I had. It had been a long time since I had seen it for obvious reasons. It's one of those that I don't feel like it's a movie you come back to again and again. Once you've seen it, you're like, well, that was a story, and that sure happened. But it's not one that really, you know, I came running back too often. Yeah. I'd rather watch My Fair Lady. it had been a while, but it's certainly didn't age well, did it?
I think there are aspects of it that are wonderful and timeless. The story itself we'll get into. I think if we were watching this movie in 1958, we would have a different opinion.
I'm certain we would.
A lot of things have happened in the ensuing decades that have not been kind to the movie. Eric, what are your first impressions?
All right, so movie musicals aren't my bag, so but I had seen this movie before. I'll be really honest, I've turned this movie off more times than I've watched it, though. It's not my favorite. And when we talk about putting it in the proper context, I don't think the plot is any more absurd than Shakespeare. You know, right? So, I mean, just because it's 1900 doesn't mean that it was any more woke or anything like that. And so when we look at it from the perspective of 2021, yeah, there's certainly going to be problematic elements of it, but there's problematic elements of Shakespeare too. And I'm by no means saying that Gigi is Shakespeare, but it certainly isn't, it doesn't have a bad heart at all.
No.
You know, it's a Lerner and Lowe musical. So you kind of have to look at it through that lens and understand that they were trying to tell a story of love and romance in this very particular time period with these very, very peculiar sort of set of rules. And I also compare it to sort of Bridgerton, if anyone has seen that show, where, you know, there's a courting ritual that was sort of going on in the 1900 Paris time frame that we really have to get an understanding of. So there's a lot of that has to happen in this movie too. It kind of drags it down though. There's a bit of this movie that is a bit of a bore, and there's something about this movie that I've never really loved. And I think it really didn't come to me until I was thinking about Brandon, our conversation with Jeremy, the writer of the 52 essential films for who we just interviewed. And he said something about, and I'm paraphrasing his quote here, that movies are a visual medium. Uh-huh. And there's frequently, when you take a movie musical and you try to put it in the any type of stage adaptation and you try to put it into a movie format, uh-huh, it loses something because the staging is so different. You know, when you have a musical and you have just people sitting on stage and singing, a lot of times that's enough. This movie's got people sitting and singing all the time. And it unfortunately doesn't have the excitement factor. What's that?
Movement?
None. Zero. I mean,
everyone's sitting still all the time.
And so it's a huge question mark as to why, though. Because you have Vincente Minnelli, and the producer, Brandon, his name is escaping me, Arthur Freed. They are geniuses, mm-hmm, and they did American in Paris just a few years previously, mm-hmm, which is just a movement masterpiece.
Right.
So to put a movie like this together, my first impression was like, really? This is all they could come up with? Because it's, and I'm sure we'll get into awards. It's certainly won its accolades, but there are really some parts of this film that just do not work.
Uh-huh. Of the 47 musicals that Arthur Free produced in his long career, this was the highest grossing, most award winning.
Yeah.
So,
this was
the guy who did Singing in the Rain, Meet Me in St. Louis, An American in Paris, The Bandwagon, Easter Parade.
Confusing to me.
Right? That's the word I should have said.
It's so confusing to me that it did as well as it did at the time. Why do people like this movie?
Well, on paper, it should be everything. It should really work.
It is
the costuming and the setting. It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful looking movie,
but it's static.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get into let's get into the cast first of all. Our leading player is Leslie Caron, who plays Gigi, who had been discovered by Arthur Freed and Gene Kelly 7 years before for An American in Paris. Was not an actress, but came into her own and learned from the best in that movie. And, forged a little career. I've always found her very mesmerizing on screen. She's not your typical looking leading lady from that time. There's something very naturalistic about her, and so she fits into this kind of ugly duckling Cinderella kind of story that they're trying to set up for her. But I think that I can't imagine what it was like, because she was a grown 28-year-old mother at that time, and so trying to go back and, you know, she at the beginning she has to be a girl and then, you know, transform into a woman at the end. But I think she plays both parts well. I mean, the script gives the other characters more to do than her, even though I think even though I think it has good intentions, and really she steers, it's really what Gigi wants most of the time, because the action's revolving around her. But I don't think that the script gives her enough meat to really sort of outshine her supporting cast.
She disappears for a third of the movie, though. Yeah. You know, yeah. The first third of the movie, where they have her playing bit parts, and it's another strange choice in a series of strange choices. Mm-hmm. The other one, though, is that she doesn't move. You know, we see her in American in Paris with wonderful ballet skill.
Right. Why not let her dance?
Right. And I get it. It doesn't have to be a dancing musical, mm-hmm. But for a good chunk of the time, yeah, she's barely moving. And when we get into favorite scenes, when she is moving and she's playing a little, doing a little waltz with the Gaston character, she's electrifying. You know, she really lights up the screen. I love her. She's like you said, Brandon, she's got something about her that is sort of not a classic beauty, but a very beautiful person and a great actress. Fine choice for a musical, too. I mean, Allison, I'm no singer. I mean,
I got a lot of feelings about the singing in this movie.
To me, she's not. Yeah, she's one of the better in a group of non-superlative singers in my mind.
Well, yes. she's dubbed in this movie.
Okay. And, yes. You know, there's times where it looked very much like mm-hmm. that to me. Mm-hmm. But there are other times where it looked like she was singing. But she does a good job in this movie.
Nobody in this movie is a great singer.
Which is strange. If you're going to dub them, why wouldn't you go find
the one of them
greatest singers to do it?
Right. Ugh. One of my notes in this was a musical where no one can sing.
All right, Allison, what are your thoughts though on Leslie Caron?
I enjoyed her. I thought she was underutilized. Mm-hmm. I think she's the most fun when they let her move around, when they let her, like when she's being a little kid at the beginning and she's like goofing off, you know, mm-hmm. When they make her be still, she loses some of what makes her exciting and interesting. Cause her movement is very, I don't know exactly what it is about it, but the way she moves, it may be because she has that dance background, mm-hmm. The way that she moves draws you in. And for so much of this movie, she's either completely absent or being talked about, mm-hmm. While she like sits still somewhere mm-hmm. else. And she's super underutilized.
Yeah. I do love though what Minnelli does through a lot of the staging is, you know, most of the women sit very still. You know, I think about like the tennis mm-hmm. match when they're on the Riviera, and the reason that, you know, Gaston is so drawn to Gigi is she's full of life compared mm-hmm. to these other women who are just, you know, made to pose and made to, you know, she's full of, you know, this effervescence, you know, although, you know, but we only get small glimpses of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think for, you know, for what she was given, you know, she's fantastic. And she, there's other wonderful movies where she gets a lot of media roles. I am a Leslie Caron fan, but
I was going to say, I'd like to reiterate that. I mean, some of those scenes mm-hmm. where she's got those very contrasting, very physical things that she's doing. She's romping in the ocean. She's, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. jumping on the back of a donkey. Those are the highlights of the movie. And it's because of the work they gave her to do, and that she carries those mm-hmm. scenes.
And next month, you and I are going to talk about another movie that she's in where she gets to show off.
Right. We'll really get
talent.
To celebrate her then. Absolutely.
They didn't do her any favors here.
But let's talk about the leading man though, Louis Jourdan, who plays Gaston in the movie. And he really is, he's the main character of the movie because he's the one that goes through the she goes through a physical transformation, but he goes through more of a, an emotional transformation although it is kind of unusual. I was thinking, you know, he abides by what she wants most of the time. So that's interesting. But Allison, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on Louis Jourdan and the role of Gaston?
Louis Jourdan does a nice job with a part that I think is kind of gross. yeah, he does a nice job with the part that I think is kind of gross. Yeah, that's all I got there.
Let me ask then, what is gross about it to you? I agree, there are gross aspects to this, but this is a good chance to expound on those.
So, I mean, obviously it's 2021 when we're watching this, and our culture has some better understanding of things like consent and age and how that all plays into things. Their relationship, he's clearly much, much older.
Mm-hmm.
He has a whole song about how she is a child.
True. Yeah.
An entire song. He's like, she's a babe, she's a child, but she's hot, but she's a child. And I'm like, the whole time I was like, ew, gross. Ugh.
Yeah.
Regardless of the time period in which that is happening, that conversation is a problem.
Is she a literal child?
I would say she's probably a teenager. I think she's supposed to be like 16-ish.
Yeah. We didn't really explain this in the beginning, but the courtesan is basically a high class prostitute. Yeah. That these young girls were being trained to be. And they do make it, I read, you know, the Hays Code had a big problem with this movie. I don't know how it got past I think they eventually just gave up and said, we trust Minnelli and Freed, do what you want or whatever. But there are a couple of scenes where, between Annalicia and her grandma, where they do make it clear that she is of consenting age. They had to relent to that. So she's just on the cusp.
He's clearly...
Yeah.
Like, this is not... He's not just met her.
Right. Like, he's known her since
he's known her and has doted on her as, like a niece or a younger sister. Mm-hmm. Or, like, bringing her little presents. And she clearly... did not enter her mind to look at him in that way. Mm-hmm. She was told by her grandmother and her great aunt, here's what you're going to do. They decided for her and she didn't want to do it. And it feels like everyone around her really manipulated her. You know, because she comes out and says, I guess I'd rather be miserable with you than without you. That's not great.
Yeah.
Not great. And the fact, you know, and that should have been it. He should, like, ugh, ugh. Mm-hmm. Just gross to me.
Eric, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I mean, I think all of those too are script problems. You know, if they had come right out and said she's 21, 22, or whatever it is, and you know, entering French society, there's certainly an issue with the power dynamic between the two that is completely wrong. There's a piece of that song, though, that shows the real struggle that character is going through. And I think that's where our actor is actually having some of his best moments, where in that song, and regardless of what the lyrics are saying, he's going through these sort of pacings of what's right and what's wrong. And mm-hmm. he's almost having this like Smeagol Gollum moment with himself, where the way he's acting is very different when he's in either part of his mind. So I think we got another actor who's, he's giving a real challenge to do here. Mm-hmm. But he comes across as, for what it's worth, romantic. He comes across as funny when he and the uncle are spying on the uncle's mistress, and you know, they've got the binoculars and things like that. There are funny aspects to it too. So, the script's got huge problems with it. Yeah.
But yeah, he does a nice job with a part that's kind of gross.
Yeah, exactly. But again, kind of Shakespeare. There's some really gross characters in Shakespeare too that are well acted, well performed. And so I got to give him credit for that.
Oh, yeah.
He did what he could with this.
Yeah, and you know, it's just interesting. And Louis Jordan, there's a documentary that I watched about the making of it, and Leslie Caron explains, you know, Louis Jordan was just unhappy the whole time the making of the movie because he thought he was terrible. He said, "I'm not a singer. Why are you hiring me for this?" And they said, "Well, we made a non-singer out of Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady, and it was successful. So we're going to have you do the same thing, speak sing." So,
and they sure did.
but Louis Jordan tries, but there was a power in Rex Harrison's speak singing that he just doesn't have,
right?
And so and you know, we'll get into the score because I think there's some highlights that we'll talk about, but let's talk really the I think the person that most people think about when they think of this movie is Maurice Chevalier as Honoré Lachaille. And if you want to know where Jerry Orbach got the interpretation for Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast, it's an imitation of Maurice Chevalier. The American public from the 20s through the 60s, their idea of a typical French person was Maurice Chevalier. Mm-hmm. And he made his mark in the, you know, musicals in the 30s and then fell out of favor with the American public in the 40s because he had performed for some of the German armies at the time and was labeled like a French, you know, associate of the Germans. And even though that might not have necessarily been true, he was denied a visa to come back to the USA for years and finally made it back in the mid-50s. And this was kind of his big return. And so a lot of the movie is built around him. He's our narrator. And, you know, the Chevalier, there's always, you know, there's this great, you know, French charm about him. And he's got some problematic stuff too, though. So Eric, yes. Eric, let's start with you. What are your impressions of Chevalier?
Yeah. And again, he's singing songs that people wrote for him. Right. Is he singing them particularly well? Yeah, he does an okay job in my mind, where more like, we're going to have you speak sing these things. The guy's got great teeth. He's smiling every other sentence, you know, and that's part of the sort of charm that he has. Again, there's so much of this movie that is sort of flat dialogue. He's got this history with the Madame Alvarez character. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, they share a number together and it's a decent scene, but again, they're just sitting there.
Yeah.
I feel like if that were done on a stage, they'd be up and moving around even. So give them a little more to do. Because I think the guy could handle it. It looked like he's a comedic actor too, you know? So you got a guy that's kind of a triple threat here. Give him some stuff to do.
Allison.
Absolutely. I think he's clearly just incredibly charming. Like, I would love to have seen them let him do anything. That scene on the balcony, they literally just sit at a table and look at each other and kind of sort of sing. And it could have so much more life.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that on a stage they would just sit and sing. Like, I am not a professional Broadway level director, but I direct high schoolers, but I would not block it that way.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have, you know, it has this push and pull that you don't, like, the lyrics give you push and pull that you don't get in the movement, and it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
I'd love to see him, be a little silly, you know, be a little smarmy, do things.
He is wonderful in a movie that came out the year before this called Love in the Afternoon with Audrey Hepburn and Gary Cooper and directed by Billy Wilder. And he plays an associate of Audrey Hepburn's. It's really, really funny. So he has that ability. They just didn't really give him that. And, but, you know, and we'll get into the song in a little bit, but let's talk about and we'll talk about them together. Aunt Alicia, played by Isabel Jeans, and then Grandma Alvarez, played by Hermione Gingold. I think great comedic performances by both of them, although they're two of the biggest manipulators in the movie.
Yeah.
although by the end, Grandma sort of realizes, you know, she sort of gets a moral compass toward the end. But
yeah, at the very last minute.
Allison, what are your opinions on those two?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, they have some really funny stuff where they're like trying to teach Gigi how to eat, you know, those whole kind of etiquette lesson scenes. I love the running bit that every time you hear the mom warming up, they just go shut the door. Like, they're just like, no. And yeah, I think they are, despite being two of the more manipulative characters, two of the more likable characters. And they clearly, you know, the grandmother clearly wants what she perceives as the best life for Gigi. It's her perceptions are just kind of skewed. They mean well, you know, and their work that they do on stage is very fun. The whole jewelry scene with the great aunt, she's just like, this child's an idiot, like the whole time, or the coffee thing, you know, I think they did a really nice job.
My favorite,
they did a nice job with some problematic material.
My favorite line of Annalise's is when she tells Gigi not to flop in the chair, insinuate herself.
Yes.
Eric, yeah, what are your thoughts?
And that character, the Annalicia character, has the meatiest sort of comedy in the movie. I would have loved to have seen that even played even a little bigger, a little more broad. But it works, and it's not too much. I love the way that she is reacting. She's receiving a telephone call while in the bath, and you have this sort of very comedic moment too of the two characters interacting there at Annalicia's house too. So they're great on screen together. Even they work really well apart too. They're you know, they're not one character. They're not lumped together. These actresses do both give very good performances in this film.
Yeah, let's move on. Let's talk about particular scenes or musical numbers in the movie, because there I think that the one thing that this movie might be underrated about is the score. I think there are some wonderful songs in the movie. You know, the actual numbers aren't as lively as your typical MGM musical numbers would be, but in terms of actual melodies, I think some of Lerner and Lowe's prettiest work is in this movie, and I think that My Fair Lady maybe unfortunately overshadow it sometimes. But Allison, we'll start with you. Do you have a favorite number or a favorite scene?
The music itself is really lovely, and I wish that the people cast in it could sing it better. because it's like fun, but it loses, I mean, part of it, the blocking, you know, there's no movement, so it loses the fun. I think the Parisians, the song that Gigi sings about how she's like, I don't understand why everybody's doing this, everybody's just kissing all the time. I enjoy that song. She's just like, this is so dumb, do they not have anything better to do? I think that one is really nice. And then I also really enjoyed Maurice Chevalier's I'm Glad I'm Not Young Anymore. I think that was one of his better moments in, you know, one of his best moments where they really just let him go. Yeah, those are probably my two favorites. As far as songs, I could tell you I got a real problem with one.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, I got a real big problem with Thank Heaven for Little Girls.
Which is the signature song of the movie.
But yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, and the thing that gets me about the song is, yeah, it makes me cringe when I hear the lyrics as well. There were good intentions when they wrote it. I don't think there is anything yucky in their minds when they were writing it.
They meant well, but they did not pull it off.
I think maybe at the time, though, and I think there's a line there that sort of is protecting them. It's the what would little boys do?
Yeah. They're like, hold on, let's be real clear. We're talking about kids and other kids.
Yeah.
But it's like afterthought. You know, they've said all these things that are kind of yucky. And then they're like, what would little boys do?
and the character of Honoré, it's obvious he is not into little girls. He is into grown women, younger women, but grown
women. Much younger. But yeah,
but it doesn't help the cause that character, that Honoré, is a cad. That he is, you know, he's playing the mistress game, and that he uses women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the song were sung by Aunt Honoré, you know, would we look at it a little differently, or a chorus of children? You know, I mean,
and here's when they made a Broadway musical of this in 73. It was, but then they revived it a few years ago, and they changed it to have the two aunts singing "Thank Heaven for Little Girls."
That's a different choice then, yeah,
and it helps because when you have an old man who is into younger women. And plays the field all the time, singing about "Thank Heaven for Little Girls." Mm-hmm. It's kind of gross.
I agree 100%. This is one of the better shot songs in the musical. It's dynamic. There's perspective issues with the carriages, like when the people are waving at each other. It's like those shots don't line up. It's kind of like when you see a car chase scene, you're like, those cars aren't in the right position to each other. But that opening scene is one of the better shot scenes of the movie. And Allison, I do want to go back to the one that you were talking about, the number about Parisians, that I, in my mind, see that as almost like, we're getting into that character's mind, and that character's making some real decisions about their lives, and it's the same type of scene as the "I Have Confidence in Me" song from Sound of Music, and they're shot just so completely differently that and I think when we discussed that film, Brandon, I was like, this is how you shoot a movie musical. You do it like the Sound of Music. And they took all of that and they threw it out the window.
It worked, but let's forget it.
Well, the funny thing is, they are shooting this movie on location in Paris, actually. You know, the Minnelli hated having to recreate Paris on the back lots at MGM when they did An American in Paris. And so they got permission finally to go over, which is why this movie ended up costing so much. And you could tell he's having a ball shooting a lot of these locations.
Wonderful Paris. Colors.
Stunningly beautiful.
Leslie Caron says part of the big hassle that they had while they were shooting this was Paris by 58 had become so modernized. It was hard to find places where you couldn't see telephone poles, where you couldn't see satellite towers, things like that. So they had to be very specific in how they shot stuff. And I'm wondering if that might be why some things are static, because it was impossible to shoot anything that wasn't modern at the time. But yeah, he still could have moved the camera a little bit. And Minnelli, who is one of my favorite directors, was known for doing crazy stuff.
Right. And that's why this one to me is a head scratcher.
Uh-huh.
But I like how he shoots The Night They Invented Champagne. And that number's fun.
Oh, that one is really, it's very cute.
It's very fun. It's cute. Yeah absolutely. Everybody's having a good time in that.
And it's three people in a small space, but he shoots it very interestingly.
Right. And there's, you know.
And they move.
Yeah.
Well, and, And Leslie Caron's kind of reaching across the table and hiding the fact that she's sipping the champagne. And it's really smart and well done. And there's dancing and there's characters moving in and out of the central focus. So that's a great scene. And that's another example, too. That location is a completely different color palette than anything else that you see. It's those deep velvety reds, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's called, I think, whenever I hear Liza interviewed, she always refers, people called it the Minnelli Red. He had a specific shade of red that is in every movie, if you look at it at some point. But maybe when we talk about An American in Paris, I'm sure there's Minnelli Red that we can talk about. But
we'll find it.
But I do like, even though I get what you're saying about it being static, I think there's a great poignancy to I Remember It Well, having these two older these two older people in the twilight of their lives and the setting sun behind them and
the
everything.
The song is great.
It's a great, I think it might be my favorite song in the movie just because there's such a poignancy to it.
Yeah, the song is lovely. I wish they would have done more with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I love, the song that I love is She's Not Thinking of Me when he is on the date with Ava Gabor, who plays, because it's so, there's subtext to what's going on. You're listening to his thoughts and Ava Gabor, it's very, she's doing great because she is not doing the same thing. She's mimicking this 3-minute song and she's not doing any of the same thing twice. And for those of you, this is the first time we've talked about a Gabor on classics, but people tend to confuse her and her sister Zsa Zsa. Ava was the actress in the family. Zsa Zsa was famous for being Zsa Zsa.
Yes.
For slapping cops. Ava
in this movie is Lisa from Green Acres and Bianca from The Rescuers and The Rescuers Down Under. This is the one you're probably the most familiar with. She does, for the couple of little scenes she gets, I think she steals some of those scenes. She's very charming and bubbly.
She gets to move around and do things.
she gets to ice skate. She gets to
ice skate. She gets a drink dumped down her dress.
The scenes that are shot in Maxime's, I love the gossipy stuff, that goes on. Because first of all, there's action involved in that. It's just so cool to see, a restaurant like Maxime's, which in 58 was the same as it was in the 1890s, because they actually shot it in there. And another funny thing, they said there were only two doors to get in and out, and you stuffed all these extras and all the camera equipment in there. And they talked about how hot it was and how everyone was sweating and all of that. And they said that the ceilings, have glass mirrors at the top. And one of the boom cameras went up there and cracked the glass on one of the things. And they said Freed was going nuts. But the owners of Maxime says, we replace that glass all the time. Corks go through that ceiling when people pop the champagne bottles.
I love those scenes too, where and they give us this great presentation of it, where I think it was Uncle Honoré says, we're going to go to Maxime's, and either he or Gaston says, because nobody cares what anybody's doing there. And then they walk in, and then the minute
stops.
Everybody just freezes on a dime. Yeah. And that is great. That's what you're looking for.
That's great.
Yeah. And stillness only works in contrast with movement. And I think that is what this was lacking,
But that scene, there's this wonderful movement on, and you can see it's like a receiving line. And so the people move down that, and you can just, and then the dialogue of the whispering over that, that's a wonderful scene in this movie.
Oh yeah. And I think, we know that it can be done in this movie because we see it done in those scenes.
Right.
And it makes those other really static ones so much more disappointing because you're like, well, what about that? Where did that go?
Yeah. Yeah. There are some interesting decisions in this movie. Also,
choices were made.
And also the title song Gigi, which, we've talked about, the stuff about her being, it's a beautiful melody.
Mm-hmm.
And Jordan, for as much as he says he wasn't a singer, for being a non-singer, I think he handles it okay.
It does okay. Yeah.
But I think it takes a while to get there, but I enjoy the scene between Gaston and Grandmama when she finally realizes that, oh, Gigi's about to go out with him. She has that great line about, you know, I can't laugh about it when I see it in the papers like I do, you know, with her. You know, when you finally get into the meaty stuff, I think is when the movie finally comes alive and becomes a little less static. And you have sort of that moral ambiguity toward the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But,
it takes so long to get there, though.
I think we touched on it before, but the scenes and I guess it was the Riviera that they went to as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. I think all of those scenes are really
fun and
funny too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're beautifully shot. The scenes of them in the ocean and with trying to get on the back of the donkeys. Those are really fun and funny.
Jordan
scenes.
Just goes all the way over.
Yeah.
It's great. Those are the fun. Yeah. Those are the moments where you're like, can we not have this throughout?
Mm-hmm.
The song for me that's always the hardest to get through, and it's aptly named, it's a bore.
You could see how they're trying really hard to Rex Harrison this thing, and it is
that was a song that should have been sung.
Mm-hmm.
And also that's like the one scene that you can tell they didn't shoot in Paris. You can tell it's a screen behind them.
So. Yeah,
but they don't move an inch. They're sitting in a carriage and a screen moves behind them and
it's a bore.
Every time he said that, I was like, yes, it is.
And it's a patter song, and patter songs should be so fun.
Yeah.
And it's
and the lyrics are very witty, and it could have been such a I'm sure that it was just hard to do a full carriage ride through Paris because you would see modernized aspects of the city. But yeah, I feel like they could have just kept it to like a nice location, and that would have added to the energy just a little bit more. But so let's talk about the ending though. Let's talk about you have Gigi and Gaston going to Maxime's, and she is the perfect courtesan. Her aunt has mm-hmm. trained her well, and it's Honoré who sort of is the turning point because he makes these frivolous comments about her, and Gaston realizes, you know, I do love her, and she was right earlier on when she said, if you love me, how could you put me through this kind of life, mm-hmm. and drags her, you know, drags her home. And I think some of the most beautifully photographed scenes in the movie are after he leaves her and he walks through Paris at midnight and you get mm-hmm. his silhouette in front of the fountain.
That's gorgeous.
That's a classic Minnelli shot. And then when he's walking through and you got the streetlight shining off of the cobblestone, that's, you know, vintage Minnelli as well. And then of course he goes back into the apartment to ask for, you know, grandma's hand in marriage, or not grandma's.
It's a different movie, sir. That
would have been a twist ending.
They might have been. She might have been closer in age to him.
Wow.
No, but you know, and apparently, I read though they actually had to go back and reshoot Grandmama's final line when she says "Thank heaven," which leads into the end, because she said it in a very sarcastic way, like "Thank heaven, it's about time." But they said, "No, this needs to be a heartfelt ending, sweetness," and they had her say that, and she delivers that well. But how do you think the ending plays out, Eric?
Yeah, it's sweet. There's sort of a redemptive quality mm-hmm. to it, because at the end of the day, it's a story about love. And you know, if we make the assumption that Gigi is old enough to give consensual her hand consensually in marriage, then it's a sweet story of mm-hmm. these two people that fall in love, and we assume then have a long and lovely life together after that. He's learned a lesson not to play the field that he was bored of. She learns a lesson that she doesn't have to be this courtesan for the rest of her life. So I enjoy that. It's a great way to end a movie like this.
Yeah, Allison?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it takes us out of gross territory into sweet territory, thank goodness, because I don't know, if it just ended like, okay, she's a mistress now. But yeah, I mean, he needed a redemptive moment. He needed some real growth, because, you know, if he's our protagonist, if he's not gone on any sort of journey and he hasn't really learned anything, if that doesn't happen,
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's important that it ends that way. Otherwise, kind of what's the point?
Yeah,
I think I didn't know that they had to re-record that line. That would have really kind of colored it differently.
Yeah,
it needs the sincerity at the end. Yeah, I think because the ending was nice.
That means then that the grandmother learned a lesson too. You
right.
know, she yeah. has a story
she
arc
has
here.
A redemptive
is different.
Arc too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. They did a few reshoots of different line readings because when they previewed the movie, audiences were giving it because I think they had like a five. There was excellent, good, fair, poor, terrible, or something like that, and it was getting a lot of fair and poor marks. Mm-hmm. And then once they changed some of those line readings, the ratings went up from the audiences mm-hmm. and the previews. So yeah. The one thing I want to touch on though before we get to like you know reactions and all that stuff. The costumes and the scenery in this movie are stunning. And Cecil Beaton, who did all of the costumes and designs for My Fair Lady as well, did it. And, you know, it's beautifully done. And Minnelli loved the art world. And so you can tell he's trying to compose things like they're moving paintings a lot of the time. And yeah. it's just beautiful to look at.
Well, sometimes they're moving.
Well, yeah. or still paintings. Yeah. Yeah. And then also the, we talked about, you know, the music and Lerner Lowe, but the arrangements and the orchestrations by Conrad Salinger and Andre Previn in this
lovely.
Movie are just lovely. And I don't think me being a lover of movie musicals, there was no greater orchestra in Hollywood at that time than the MGM orchestra. There was just such a full sound to that. And, mm-hmm. and Gigi has that. And Gigi is known as the last great MGM musical, because musicals were going out of fashion in the late 50s, and Arthur Freed would only make one more musical after this, Bells Are Ringing, and it wasn't quite as big a hit, but, you know, they had a great run, and, you know, it is interesting, though, that of all those great MGM musicals, that this was kind of the final period on the sentence, but it succeeded.
it did great.
Before we move out of scenes, though, yeah. I would like to have a brief discussion about the scene after Ava Gabor is sort of her character is found out. Mm-hmm. There is this entire discussion about the fact that she attempts suicide.
Attempts suicide, yeah.
Yeah, and there's this sort of Gaston, Uncle Honoré moment where they're high-fiving over it. And it's like,
yeah.
And it's very, very, it's disgusting,
it's
honestly.
It's gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like, ooh-wee. That was a big thing where I was like, wow, 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 wow. In no context, in no time period, is this okay?
Right.
Yeah. Like, you ruined a person's life. They tried to take their own life. That's not funny.
Well, and then in the next scene, Aunt Alicia and Grandmama are talking about it frivolously, like she did it
yeah.
again, you know, and they, you know, so because apparently this is something she does regularly, but still, it's
right.
still, it's yeah. not, yeah, it, I don't think, yeah, it's very poor taste.
Yeah, yeah, I was trying to look on, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, that was part of, you know, the French humor of the day, but still, I don't know how. Yeah, yeah, it, yeah. Very. I think that stuck out to me more than anything else. I don't know why, but thanks for bringing that up, Eric. But yeah, it's, yeah, something that was never okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's move on, though, to actual reactions to the movie. You know, the budget for this movie, because they spent a lot of time in Paris, and it ended up costing them $3.3 million, which, you know, was a lot in 58, but the movie grossed $13.2 million, and they decided not to open it in an actual movie theater. They opened it at a Broadway theater in New York because they wanted to treat it like a Broadway opening. So they brought in a screen on the stage and they opened it like it was and they did a roadshow engagement of the movie, which was they upped the ticket prices. You had to reserve your seats. You got a program. There was an intermission. It was treated like a live stage show.
Huh.
And they did that on the regularly in the late 50s. Or they did that with My Fair Lady and West Side Story.
Make it an event.
Yeah.
They made it an event, which I wish they would kind of do again with big movies.
Yeah. Hey.
Yeah.
everybody really, really, really wants to leave their houses.
I know. I know. Maybe that remake of West Side Story coming out this year, they could do something with or something.
They should have done that for Cats.
Let's not get into Lou's territory here. but it's amazing. Yeah, the critical reception. Here is what Bosley Crowther of the New York Times says. It's a musical film that bears such a basic resemblance to My Fair Lady that the authors may want to sue themselves. but don't think that this point of resemblance is made in criticism of the film. For Gigi is a charming entertainment that can stand on its own legs. It's not only a charming comprehension of the spicy confection of Colette, but it's also a lovely and lyrical entanglement upon the story's flavored mood and atmosphere. Vincent Minnelli has marshaled a cast to give a set of performances that, for quality and harmony, are superb.
Yeah, all the ingredients are there for that, and right. You know, it's Lerner and Lowe. And I will say, I think that some of the lyrics we've said we've got some problems with. I do think this is one of the more cleverly written librettos as far as the lyrics to these right. songs go. So, yeah, I mean, and there are certainly good points about it, but. That review, I can't agree with it, you know?
Yeah.
And Bosley Crowther didn't like anything, so he actually...
Wild.
But, okay, and then Oscar nominations. So it was nominated for 9 Oscars, and this is interesting. It held the record for a while of being the movie that won that won every single Oscar it was nominated for with the most. So it was nominated for 9 Oscars. It won all 9, and a movie wouldn't do that again until Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, which is nominated for 11 and won 11. Mm. So it was nominated and won all of these. It won best scoring of a musical picture for Andre Previn, best editing, costume design, cinematography, art direction, adapted screenplay, best song for Gigi, the title song, best director for Vincent Minnelli, and best picture. So yeah, 9 Oscars. And it's because we still had quite a few musicals that would win best pictures after that.
It's funny that it won, you know, all of those, and there's like no acting awards.
No.
Not one acting award.
I don't know. It feels like the Academy got it wrong on several of these categories. Mm-hmm. There's 3 that I would probably really agree with like the art direction, the
costume design.
Yeah, but I mean,
the scoring.
The score is scoring. Great. There doesn't seem to be a great editing. What about this in editing?
What about it?
What did lead you to believe it's Academy Award worthy?
I mean, And to give you an idea of the movies that came out in 1958 that it beat, let me see, it beat The Defiant Ones, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Anti-Mame, Separate Tables, and then a movie that came out that year that wasn't nominated for anything, Vertigo.
Yeah, right? So there were politics going on in Hollywood at this time.
Oh, yes, because there are better movies on that list.
Yeah, and
Annie Mame is an example of a much better female-led, mm-hmm. very funny, very well-shot, very dynamic movie that should win in a couple of other of these categories. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm going to stop beating up this movie now, but I watching this on television, which is where I saw it this time, and obviously where we have to get it. Some of the like the photographs or the not the title cards, but those ones of the newspapers that they show. Mm-hmm. There were pieces of it that were out of focus that I noticed watching the movie, and I was like, I couldn't tell if that was because the film had been warped over time or something like that, or if they were just shot that way. If they were shot that way, shame on them. And they shouldn't get cinematography awards for something like that. Having a mistake like that too is that should pull them out of contention for that award. So
are you talking about the like the opening title cards?
No, I'm talking about when they would
the newspaper close-ups.
Gigi would be reading those their newspapers, but mm-hmm. they're sort of they look more like menus, and you would see those, and then they would show like when Gaston was taking his holidays, they would it would show the what he was doing in those newspapers. There were pieces of those that were out of focus on the screen, and it and again, it could be just the film didn't keep up for whenever they digitized that the film had degraded enough that those pieces got out of focus. But it's it looked to me like it was kind of sloppy cinematography. So
I didn't notice that. I'll have to go back and look again, but I don't know, maybe because this movie was shot in a process that didn't last very long, so I'm wondering if it just wasn't a good film stock.
It could be. Absolutely. Yeah, it could 100% be that. And there are times too where color shifts on this. So I'm wondering if it was a degradation in the actual physical film, not how it was shot initially and not how it would have been viewed initially. Mm-hmm. So maybe our perspective again in 2021 is skewed just because we didn't get to see that original print on some of those technical details.
Yeah. It is interesting. This movie, when you look at like BuzzFeed or any other article that ranks all of the movies that have won Best Picture, it's usually toward the bottom five. I think it's people usually this, The Greatest Show on Earth. I'm trying to think of some of the other. Oliver is usually down there. Although I think Oliver is a great movie.
Oliver, though.
As far as movie musicals go, I would take Oliver over this.
How Green Was My Valley, we need to do an episode on that, but I think it unfairly gets maligned just because it beat Citizen Kane, but it's a beautiful movie. But also, you know, Gigi was put on the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. And then the American Film Institute in 2002 put it as number 35 on the greatest love stories of all time and ranked Thank Heaven for Little Girls in 2007 the 56th greatest movie song of all time.
Hard disagree.
So, and that's in the 2000s. So
hard disagree.
And I noticed when I was reading through this, there are people genuinely, I mean, who love this movie. And
I know.
And I've a couple of like musical critics that I read can call it like the perfect movie musical. So there, this is a movie that's been polarizing. There are people who love it. There are people who hate it. I've always ridden the middle. I think there are wonderful things about it, redeeming things. But yeah, but there are just some things where I can't fully embrace it.
Yeah, it's okay, but I'd rather watch My Fair Lady.
I put musicals into two kids. You know, there's the movies that are based off of Broadway musicals, and I like My Fair Lady and Sound of Music, whereas this was an original movie musical. And when I put it up against other original movie musicals like Singin' in the Rain or any of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers musicals and stuff, I'm like, there's so many other great, or An American in Paris, there's so many other great original movie musicals. I just don't know why for a long time this was considered the apex of the movie musical. I think sometime in the 70s people started looking at Singin' in the Rain and American in Paris as that, but for a good decade and a half Gigi was considered the apex of the movie musical. So
Allison's got stunned silence is what we'll call that.
Different strokes for different folks, I guess.
So, yeah.
It's not often I don't have anything to say.
Yeah, man. So, yeah. So, let's wrap this up. Eric, final thoughts on Gigi.
There's some great pieces to this movie. And when you say it's polarizing, I'm going to come down on the side of I'm not going to hate it, but this is a movie that I'm going to say if you're looking for, particularly in the genre like you were just talking about, Brandon, of original movie musicals, this is in a not recommend category for me, and I don't think I've ever said that on this show before. So thanks, listeners, for voting this one as the one that we had to do. But there's too many pieces of it that don't work for me, and it's a real head scratcher. So at the end of the day, if you want to see most of this team together, go watch the one from a couple of years before in An American in Paris. I mean, it's just so I hate to compare films directly like that, but it's just so much a better example of a movie musical and what you can do with all of those pieces of musical numbers filmed and have great scores and performers. So if you've never seen it before, yeah, you might want to check it out, or maybe just go watch the best parts on YouTube or something like that. Because I honestly couldn't say, you know, that it, you wouldn't go to your grave with regrets if you missed this one in my book.
Allison.
Yeah. I think it's, if you are doing something else and you need something on in the background, this is great. You'll look at it and you'll be like, wow, that's pretty. And then you can go about your business doing your other things. But I wouldn't seek it out. Like I said, I watched it a long time ago and then not again until I was getting ready for this, because it's fine, but it's got some problematic pieces. And I don't think that the good parts of it, the parts that are really nice, outweigh the parts that don't work for me. So I don't love it. I don't totally hate it. Not my favorite. Rather watch My Fair Lady or Singing in the Rain.
I think I'm going to be a little more, on the other side of you, Eric. I do think if you want to really know classic musicals, I think this is one that you do need to see, just because it was considered the crown jewel at one point. I think, especially like if you want to be a completist on Best Picture winners, you need to watch it. If you want to be a completist in terms of like the work of Vincent Minnelli and Arthur Freed, I think this is a important one to watch, even though I think both of them did much better, much more enduring, timeless movies. But yeah, it's also an interesting look into French culture during a different time. I'm not as much of an expert on foreign. I'm sure there's like actual French made films that might do that a little better.
But I've
read that people who are fans of Colette's work think it was a fair representation of the novel and her work and what she was trying to go on ahead. I need to read more up on that, but yeah, it's got a lovely score. It's pretty to look at when, mm-hmm. you know, you're given pretty stuff to look at.
Yeah.
I think there is some value in just looking at it just because of what it was considered at one point. So I think just for that, you need to watch it. It's not, you know, something I'm going to lay back and watch on a lazy Sunday afternoon, but
it's good background noise.
Yeah. But before its importance. Yeah. So this is interesting. I got to say, this is actually episode 70 of Classics. And I don't think we have ever been so lukewarm on a movie before.
Yeah.
One that won nine Academy Awards. I don't get it. You know,
I'm trying to think, because I've been on quite a few, and I'm trying to think if there's ever been one that I've been
We had problems with Annie Hall, certainly because of things outside of the film. It wasn't really necessary. And the same thing with Chinatown,
because people
involved outside of the film,
but never the film itself.
Never the film itself. We kind of giggled at some things about The Great Race last mm-hmm. year, but still, I would recommend The Great Race over this. So.
Yeah.
So yeah.
This is certainly a film that exists.
It's interesting. So yeah, well, thank you, listeners, for giving us a first. So yeah, we'll maybe we won't trust the listeners. I'm just kidding. But no.
I'll accept the challenge, though.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
if there's other films that you want us to discuss like this, or the challenge that we should make, that we should put out there: is there one worse? Is there an Academy Award winner that people think is worse? And see if maybe we'll.
And you know what? It's my goal for the show. I think we do need to cover all the Best Picture winners that we can, just to see if they hold up or not.
Yeah,
and we've covered a ton of Best Picture winners on here already, but I think there are some doozies out there.
Yeah. Oh man, I just set myself up though, because The Greatest Show on Earth. I don't like that film at
They're
all.
They're gonna make you watch it now.
Yep. Show on Earth. Indeed.
You did it to yourself, Eric.
Push for How Green Was My Valley. It's less than.
It's much shorter.
It's only an hour and 50 minutes.
Shorter.
So yeah, man. So yeah, but we do. For those of you that listen, we've got some good stuff coming up. We are Eric. Do you want to tell us about it?
I think probably the next thing that we've got is a discussion of the great film noir, The Third Man. And then pretty soon after that, correct me if I'm wrong, we will be having Patricia Ward Kelly to talk about a film that we've brought up a couple of times here because it is the 70th anniversary of An American in Paris. So 1951 film and great movie musical. So if you liked this, you'll love that.
Mm-hmm. And then
watch that instead of this.
You can do both, but listen to both podcasts. Yeah. That was
really then, definitely listen to both podcasts, but watch American in Paris over Shishi.
And then also something that I think we're announcing first on this episode, we're going to be celebrating the 70th anniversary of, the 80th anniversary of Citizen Kane, the first week of May. And Aaron McCabe, who just watched it for the first time, is going to join us to talk about that. Jeremy and Lou and I did a Citizen Kane episode a couple years ago, so we already did a comprehensive discussion of the movie. So now it'll just be fun to talk about smaller aspects of the movie and other, side, topics we want to discuss. So that'll be fun.
Cool.
So yeah.
And I'm on the record as saying that is my favorite movie of all time. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
And then next year is the 80th anniversary of my favorite movie, Casablanca. So we'll have to cover that.
And we've done that one before too.
We've done that one too.
I was on that one.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll have to look at that from another angle too. So I'm excited about that. So yeah, a lot coming up. If you want to be involved in more of our polls and want to punish us just like you did this time, we'll join our Facebook group, Front Row Classics Podcast. You can find it easily if you search it. Click join. Eric and I will approve you. We promise. And then you can also find us at FRN Classics Pod on Instagram, or if you have a movie suggestion, email us at classicsfrn@gmail.com. So plenty of ways to reach us, plenty of movies to watch. We got a ton of movies still to watch between the silent era through the 70s. It'll never end. So so just looking forward to that. So for this episode of Front Row Classics, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Eric Flick.
And I'm Allison Means.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.